Thank you for checking out Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. It really means a lot to me that you're listening to this podcast. If you listen and you like the content, then make sure you subscribe, make sure you leave a review. Please do that. And also go check me out on some of my other platforms. I have a long-running YouTube channel. I've got a blog, theclinicaltrialsguru.com. If you're interested in becoming a CRA or you're interested in getting a career in this industry, go to thecraacademy.com. If you're a research site owner interested in getting more studies for your site or negotiating better contracts for your site, go to my blog, theclinicaltrialsguru.com, and check it out. I offer consulting services. If you're a pharma, biotech, life sciences company, a CRO, I own a startup CRO, and we're here to help you, whatever it is you want. If you're a CRO, we can white label a lot of services for you. We have CRA coverage across the country at cost. We can do this at scale. If you're a pharma company, we are a full service CRO, and we're very confident in our pricing, and we are extremely competitive at bidding. And if you're also interested in your own digital marketing and leveraging a podcast maybe for yourself, reach out to me, dan@theclinicaltrialsguru.com. Again, thank you very much and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the debut of BBK Worldwide's Pharma 15 Live, where industry experts square off on the burning issues of clinical R&D. I'm Caitlin Kelleher from Cambridge Health Tech Institute. I'll be your host and moderator. Today, our panelists will be facing off on the topic of direct-to-consumer advertising to support clinical trial recruitment and enrollment. Taking on the challenge are Matt Kibbe, president and a principal of BBK Worldwide. Matt is a 20-year veteran of BBK and provides executive-level consultation for leading pharma and biotech companies. Dan Svera, site owner and CEO of the Clinical Trial Guru. Dan is dedicated to advancing the clinical research industry through discussions with industry leaders and experts, and he is a prolific industry blogger with an extensive online presence. Xuan Gui, head of digital strategy for global clinical operations at Biogen. Xuan is a recognized pioneer in digital health and social pharma, as well as a well-respected industry thought leader who has earned numerous industry accolades. Following the debate, we will go into overtime. You can join the rebuttal by emailing questions to info@bbkworldwide.com. So let's get started. Xuan, advertising, is it just about referrals?
Sure. So I think, you know, obviously the goal of any study is really to get as many enrolled patients as possible and pretty much as quickly as possible in order for the study to complete on time. But as far as advertising goes, referrals are really the point where advertising really, in a sense, ends, because that's where you hand off to the sites and you lose control beyond that. So in terms of referrals, that is the end goal. However, patients are not equal. There are many patients along a journey, and certainly they're at different points, whether they're ready for a clinical trial, whether they even know about a clinical trial, whether they're looking for answers to their new diagnosis, and so on. So while advertising may be driving towards that goal of referrals, there's a lot of other things it can do. It can drive awareness about clinical trials. It can educate people about a certain disease or about clinical trials itself. So there are a lot of things that it does along the way, driving the patient down the journey, but certainly, you know, referrals are the end of where advertising then hands off to the sites, and it's up to the sites then to get to the point where the patient gets enrolled.
Absolutely. Matt.
So it's really gratifying to hear that. I think that one of the things, though, that that I would, you know, disagree with slightly there is that, you know, as a company that is consistently looked to for producing referrals, and I guess advertising, by the way, I guess technically is really about impressions rather than just referrals, is that if it doesn't equal enrollment, if advertising doesn't equal enrollment, which is kind of what the question is tacitly asking, I think, then, you know, is it really working? And I think we all know that advertising works. I mean, that would be a much different debate. If we were debating whether advertising worked or not, we'd be talking about, you know, a multi-billion dollar industry at stake in that kind of case. I think, but whether it equals direct enrollment is another matter. And I personally feel that in that particular part of the debate, we have to be looking at the role of sites. And this is what I think Xuan was getting to in saying, okay, so what is the role that they play? And to what degree are they held accountable to converting a referral into an enrolled patient? And in some ways, you have to ask yourself, you know, why would an advertising agency, someone who is actually generating the referral, have to take on, say, a financial burden for ensuring something like that actually happening? Because sometimes that actually gets pushed on to advertising agencies. And in some cases, there are things that you can actually do to mitigate those issues. But in many cases, there aren't. So it's a fundamental kind of circular argument for the industry.
Dan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, of course, advertising is about referrals. That's what pays the bills for the sites, and that's what keeps the bills down for the pharma companies, right? But I think we need to differentiate between advertising, which is sales, and branding. And I put the onus on the sites to allocate some of the advertising budget that they get for long-term branding, right? So now the question becomes, well, who's paying for this? And I think the sites need to pay for it, but I've been able to successfully negotiate with sponsors to allocate 10%, 15%, 20%. As long as I have a proven strategy for long-term branding and we're a long-term partner as a site with that pharma company, I've had no problem doing that. And I used to, this would not even have been something I would have even considered 5 years ago. So the environment's changing, social media is changing, how we consume information is changing. And I think we, all of us, stakeholders in this industry need to adapt.
I would add on to that, actually. I would say that, you know, the thing about referrals is it has to be qualified referrals, to the point that Matt made earlier about making sure that your advertising actually does bring you the right type of people. So you can send as many referrals as you want, but if they have the wrong people, then you're just putting the burden on the sites to actually have to filter out the wrong people. And so, you know, it has to be qualified. And therefore, when it comes to getting enrolled patients in a study, you know, the advertising has to be optimized based on who you get at the end that is actually qualified for that study.
Mm-hmm. And that brings me to my next question. Do sponsors and sites feel that the quality of the referrals generated through advertising is the same through their own networks?
Well,
Dan, what are your thoughts on that?
So as a site owner, actually, and then I advise tons of sites across the country, we would never turn down referrals. Okay, now we're private sites, we're not KOL sites. There's a whole lot of variables there which we can get into. We will take any referral because that's free income, free money, right? We will lose our efforts when the 10th referral is not interested or doesn't know how we got their number. But we'll keep doing it because ultimately all we need is one screening and one randomization, and that's actually a good surge of income for a small to medium-sized clinic, even a large clinic. So referrals are welcome by sites, and I've never had a problem with a central recruitment vendor. Even if 30 of their leads are no good, if one is good, that's welcome. I haven't paid for anything.
That's, you know, that's also gratifying to hear, but it's not necessarily what we always see in practice as well, though. I mean, you know, there are times when advertising will generate hundreds and hundreds of referrals to sites. And, you know, we have to acknowledge that that does actually put an additional burden on the sites to process those referrals. But then the sites sometimes don't actually process them at all. I mean, the fundamentals of your argument there are sound, you know, that each one of those referrals does represent revenue to the site, possibly not necessarily for that one particular study, but maybe for another study, or maybe to come in and be an actual part of the panel for that particular site. But sites don't necessarily process them if they don't have the right infrastructure and revenue set up to actually be able to do that. And, you know, incidentally, along those lines, I don't really see a whole lot of feasibility modeling that goes on at sponsor organizations that considers those variables when selecting sites, even when the necessity of going beyond the patient panels of the sites is quite evident. You know, and I've asked that question quite directly, even where I haven't been involved in the feasibility study. But it feels as though, you know, that would be a necessary component of a good feasibility study, at least, in order to ensure that those referrals do get processed more accurately.
Sure. And I think, you know, it's not necessarily mutually exclusive, right? I think sites can definitely have their own network and their own database of patients that they can reach out to and Typically, that's at the start of a study. That tends to be where you start first, because they tend to have a large database that they can already reach out to. But where advertising comes in is to supplement and really increase the numbers and the referrals that go to the site, to the point earlier. And what I think needs to happen is that we need to be sure that we put the stop gaps in place to check the quality of the patients that we're referring to the site, so that we can ensure that the burden is not brought over to the sites, and that we're getting as qualified a group of people before we hand them off.
That's an interesting point as well, because, you know, if it were just about referrals, by the way, let me just kind of take a step back on that. So if it were just about referrals, as Dan was also saying, then what we could do is actually have a very unqualified referral, and we could generate tons of those. You know, we could actually flood the place with those unqualified referrals. So if that was all we were held accountable to, then we would remove the idea of highly qualified pre-screeners that the patients have to go through in order to jack up those numbers. But the idea of qualification, it's very important, because that means that the sites then feel that they're not wasting whatever precious resources they have to picking up and processing those referrals. Again, I'm about to say something, and I don't mean to sound anti-site. I want to sound pro-study more than I do anti-site when I say this, but it's actually along the lines of, you know, why aren't sites held more accountable to actually processing referrals when we see that that's not happening? All of the other major stakeholders, key stakeholders in a particular study, are held accountable to those kinds of things. But when we see that there's real data that says that sites don't do that, and we know that it could benefit the study, then why don't they do that? And why doesn't the sponsor hold them more accountable to that?
Yeah, the rabbit hole goes deep. I mean, usually what it boils down to is there's a coordinator that's overworked, and if they're going to screen, they're going to screen someone from their database before they screen a cold referral from a company that they don't know. So the issue is, how do we get these coordinators to not be so overworked, which is a much deeper issue, and obviously not one that we're really going to focus on today.
Well, I might agree with that if I saw that the site was actually processing or screening patients for the study as well. But when you see sites that haven't screened a single patient for a particular study,
yeah,
and they've got 30 referrals hanging out waiting to be processed, and they're not doing that either, then it's not really a tenable argument. So I would say that, you know, again, I'm not anti-site. There's a lot of sites that I know and love, and I think they do a great job. But in the end, if someone, if a company like our BBK Worldwide is to be held accountable to that, then of course we have to be able to make the sites actually feel accountable to processing those referrals too.
And I think, you know, sites tend to be different, right? There are some sites that are welcoming of referrals, and they'll definitely opt in to receive those. In the same way that there are some doctors that are very happy for a patient to come in with information printed out from the internet, whereas other sites just don't like doing that. They don't like getting referrals from the internet or from other advertising sources because of bad experiences they had in the past, or because they're not comfortable with that medium. So it really depends on the site itself.
Yeah, supply and demand, bottom line. When in a year like 2018, when there's so many studies out there, sites are doing more studies than they normally would be doing. So you're not just competing with patients for that study, you're competing with all your studies that you have. So that could be another issue there.
I guess it also extends beyond the studies, it also extends to all of the actual approved products as well you're competing with. So, you know, when you're actually, in many cases, you're only actually competing with approved products, where you have to have a standard of advertising sometimes, which is competing with $40 million advertising budgets across, you know, well-respected TV stations and those sorts of things as well. So when you're looking at quality of referrals and those sorts of things, you have to apply quite a bit of money behind those to be able to get those referrals. I would say that one probably valid criticism of the quality of those referrals, as we were talking about it, is perhaps the distance from the site that you can control. Obviously, that the more skilled advertising companies are going to try to look in sort of concentric circles around the site, looking at ultra-local advertising campaigns, first of all, and then expanding that sphere of influence as the study goes on, and you have to look further beyond your borders. But when you start to, you know, send referrals from beyond some kind of median value, maybe like 20-30 miles, then maybe the willingness of patients to participate in those kinds of studies starts to wane if they have to make multiple trips. But again, when those kinds of things actually rear their heads, there are other things that you can do to bolster lower the withdrawal rate of those kinds of patients in studies as well. You can provide them with reimbursement funds or travel services
we'll
to get them to the sites.
Yeah, we'll take those leads. Yeah. It's called Uber, Uber and Lyft.
Dan's site sounds pretty amazing. You know, this is one of the sites we like.
Thank you.
Schwimm, are we behind the times as an industry in terms of advertising? Are IRBs holding us back? Our sponsors? What's your take on that?
That's an interesting question. You know, my background is such that I spend many years on the commercial side of the business doing marketing, and so commercial tends to be a little bit more ahead of the game when it comes to advertising, when it comes to using multiple channels, including digital, especially these days. And so when you look at what's happening in the clinical world, it's a little bit further behind than where commercial typically is. And therefore, I would say we are behind the times because as a whole, the healthcare industry is behind compared to other parts of other industries. So yes, we are behind the times. Having said that, I think there's a lot of investment and efforts now to really start to catch up, to really try to understand where the patient is and to use the channels to reach them where they are. And so I think we're starting to get in with the game. We're starting to, you know, hit our stride in terms of catching up where advertising is with the rest of the world. And so the industry is getting there.
Matt, what's your take?
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that 2018 is going to be the first year that the digital media spend exceeds TV media spend, or something along those lines. And so if that's true generally of the advertising industry, then in some ways, you know, what we do is actually ahead of the industry, because you know we've actually been spending more on digital advertising rather than TV advertising for some time. So if that's a metric you want to use, then yeah, maybe we are ahead. But you were also asking about whether IRBs was an issue on this. And my personal take on that is I don't believe that IRBs are actually impeding anything that we do. I haven't experienced it. Let's just say in the last few years, I haven't experienced that at all. And the way that we construct our ad campaigns now are very skilled. We use a service, you know, within our own agency that allows us to remember, a memory-based system, allows us to understand and remember the types of edits that we'd receive from IRBs, and so that we can not sort of hit those pitfalls in the first place. And I'm a very, very strong believer in the Declaration of Helsinki. Human beings are not very ethical, as it generally goes, and we've already proven that, and that's why we have IRBs in place. So I have no real problem with them being there. I only think that they help service vulnerable populations. It should be there.
Yeah, I agree. I think the industry is catching up. The problem is, once we get caught up, things change again. So now we're behind again, right? So this is why I keep preaching long-term branding. Invest just a little bit into the long-term for the pharma, for the CROs, for the sites, maybe for BBK too. I know BBK is doing a lot of things like that anyways. But as far as the IRBs are concerned, I restrict my interaction with the IRBs to study-specific activities. So anything that involves me marketing my companies has nothing to do with an IRB.
Oh, yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. And also, sorry, I was going to add that, you know, when it comes to IRBs, certainly it's not just IRBs, it's any, you know, legal, regulatory group, whether it's internal or external. How educated are they about these new channels that we're using these days, about Facebook, about, you know, Twitter, about all these new digital channels that are out there? If we're going to start using those channels, these people that are taking the position of reviewing and approving materials should at least receive some form of education or understand how that medium works, so that they can understand what you're putting through and make a review based on context and not just content.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to this as well, I think that one of the things that maybe inhibits, you know, what we would recommend would be the level of conservatism of a sponsor, and that changes. You know, that's not consistent between all sponsor entities. You know, so we do have different recommendations that we would make to different companies based on what we know that they would likely tolerate, if you will, from a legal perspective. You have different levels of review, and you know, from that perspective, also some people are still shy away from things like social media, Facebook, and so on. And that's a real shame, because perhaps they don't even know that there are things like profanity filters that exist, or there is an ability to monitor comments on Facebook, and there is an ability to block people from making these comments. It's difficult to block people making comments on Facebook ads or sharing those ads, but that's what the platform's for, and they do actually bolster responses when those things happen. But I think that, you know, that is a shame for those who do have those legal issues in place.
All right, let's keep the momentum going and go into overtime. You can email your questions and comments to info@bbkworldwide.com. And I have our first question. What can the sponsor do to mitigate the loss to follow up that invariably happens with pre-qualified refer patients? And when does that mitigation most effectively begin? Dan, we can start with you.
I think it falls down on the sites. I don't think the sponsor's even allowed to reach out to the patients, right? So once they're screened, certainly once they're randomized, that's the responsibility of the principal investigator, which means it's the responsibility of a study coordinator. So lost to follow-up, hey, try retention strategies like Uber, like Lyft. You know, figure out what the problem is. Have a caregiver, have a dedicated community outreach specialist that can get the patients back in for their visits. That's not the sponsor's responsibility, in my opinion.
I think it depends where in the process it is as well. I think if it's at the point where, you know, they're referring to the site, and to Matt's point earlier about, you know, how sometimes sites have a lot of referrals waiting for them, but they haven't actually processed them yet. I mean, that is on us to try and encourage the sites to actually put those people through to an appointment so they can actually screen them. But in terms of anything, once they've signed the consent, you know, that's on the sites to actually make sure that we don't lose them after that.
Yeah, I say, you know, there are other surrogate coordinator resources that we can possibly put in place. I mean, I know that we would probably recommend something along the lines of what we call Your Study Nurse, where we can actually use an IRB-approved script to reach out back out to the patients who have passed or pre-qualified through the pre-screener, and then try to do some sort of warm connect. Once you connect with that patient, get them through to the site. I think, you know, it's my hypothesis that probably one of the greatest barriers in the referral process is the time it simply takes to connect with somebody. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I don't think I've ever haven't picked up a call from a number that I don't recognize for many years now. So if a number's coming through from a site, perhaps patients are just more hesitant to actually answer their phones. And so it may take 3 or 4 calls or 3 or 4 emails to do that. And that's what sites don't feel that they have time to do. So if we can actually take that portion of their time and then connect the two at the moment that we actually have that connection, then, you know, that's what seems to work for us. It won't work in 100% of cases, but it has a high success rate.
So a follow-up to that, do therapeutic indications dictate your advertising tactics, or can you always rely on social media or another method? What do you think?
Of course they do. I mean, you're not going to recruit an Alzheimer's patient the same way you're going to recruit an ADHD teenager. Like, there's just totally different ways that those people consume and their families consume content. So of course you're good. Of course the therapeutic indication matters.
Yeah, I think this is a point of contention that I was talking about with Matt earlier today, which was around the fact that, you know, one size does not fit all with every study. You need to come in with insights that tell me why you're using the different advertising channels to create this multi-channel approach to engaging and recruiting patients. You can't just say, well, we did this for the last study and therefore it's going to work for this study. You need to show me who is the real target, and do you have multiple personalities or different profiles and segments that you're going to target, and then tell me how you're going to get them based on the research you've done. It can't be that one size fits all.
Yeah, segmentation and media indexing, absolutely key. I mean, even when people are talking about social media, the way that each of the different major branches of social media that are used for advertising are different because the profile of the people who use them are different. And, you know, just for example, if you're looking at something like Instagram, you know, the number of folks that are over 65 years old that are using Instagram plummets. I mean, it's less than 8% penetration amongst that particular audience, but has a really high penetration amongst audiences that are from 18 to say 29 years old. Whereas Facebook might have a more level kind of level of acceptance amongst all those different audiences. I think it obviously does come down the older the audience is, but even over the age of 65, it has greater than 63% penetration amongst that audience. So, sorry, go ahead, Dan.
Oh, yeah, no, I'd like to add one thing that I do think is just starting to emerge, and some smart pharma companies are already doing it, is patient advocacy. So I do think that will work across the board, but we're so early and there's a lot of gray area. And if you talk to attorneys like Darshan Kulkarni, shout out to Darshan, you'll see that, you know, you can get in tons of trouble. I mean, we're talking about the Department of Justice. So got to be careful. It works, but tread cautiously.
All right. Our final question. With the new technology and the proliferation of wearables and real-time access to information, do you think clinical trial advertising will be affected? Shwen, we can start with you.
I'm not sure about clinical trial advertising, but certainly the whole world of healthcare is going to be affected, and there's certainly going to be a lot of changes. We're going to include wearables in a lot of our studies in the future. We're going to be able to get real-time feedback. Patients are going to have feedback. Doctors are going to have feedback. Studies are going to change, and in terms of targeting advertising, if there's an opportunity to actually tap into that data and understand what we call, you know, digital biomarkers, for example, where we can actually detect someone's or predict someone's symptoms or someone's disease based on some of the data that's being collected by the wearables, then we can target more effectively. I mean, ultimately, advertising should be about using your investment as efficiently as possible. And the more data you have to target the right type of patient to qualify for a study, the better. And so if wearables help with that, then yeah, it's going to help in the future.
Yeah, I think that from, you know, if we're thinking about, say, remote as one of the virtual trials, or Virco as one of the, you know, trials of a wireless diabetes glucose meter, things, you know, those are the major trials you think about when you think about these things. You know, it really starts to mean for advertising, I think, that you're opening up geographies. You know, perhaps you don't have to be as local around sites anymore. If you're going to have remote visits, or if you're going to have people who can sort of mail in there or wirelessly send in their information from wearable devices, you know, it might reduce the burden on the patients in terms of how often they travel back to the site. So I would say, you know, perhaps it opens up our ability to be in areas to serve populations that are not served by sites.
Yeah, this entire arena is exciting. I mean, not just wearables, but if you look at 23andMe, right? Like, I just became a member. I'm now a part of one of the largest clinical trials ever, right? And I've learned that I have a higher risk to develop celiac disease. So thankfully, I don't have any of the symptoms, but if I ever did, and 23andMe notifies me that there's a clinical trial in my area, guess what? I might consider joining it.
All right. That brings us to the end of today's lively debate. We hope you can join us for the next Pharma 15 Live when we tackle another hot topic in R&D. Thank you and enjoy the rest of your day.
So hey everybody, thank you very much for listening to another episode of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. Again, if you haven't already, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Make sure you leave a review, if you could be so kind, please. And also go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com if you're interested in learning more about who I am, who some of my guests are. You can have access to some of my YouTube videos. I do a lot of videos about clinical research. So go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com. And you can also call or text me anytime, 949-415-6256. Also follow me on any social media platform. It's Dan Svera. And you can also email me if you'd like, dan@theclinicaltrialsguru.com. Thank you very much.